non-believers of antiquity were regarded as heretics. The non-believers of today pride themselves that they are scientific intellectualists. They believe what they believe. Just as all these little priests and bishops back in the 3rd century and 4th century believed what they believed. It is a series of believings. And the Apocalypse of John and the Apocryphal writings together both challenge these acceptances of things in common circulation, but without any foundation in essential realities. Even in the times of Origen and St. Athanasius, there was a certain misgiving about the acceptances of the past in its orthodox form, that because something had always been believed did not make it infallible. It was only infallible if it was true, and it was very difficult to prove or justify some of the prevailing beliefs which were holding control of public minds even in the 3rd and 4th century. Today we have another head-on problem, but we have not yet developed a Constantine to handle it. And this problem is simply that a world divided between belief and unbelief is in a very serious condition, because it provides the grounds for all kinds of fanaticism, terrorism, and disillusionment in every area of life. Constantine liked to believe and more or less affirmed the fact that these differences are simply relatively unimportant, that the only things that are important are the unities, the things which are generally accepted. Constanza, the daughter of Constantine, finally convinced Arius to come into some kind of a compromise decision with Alexander. And perhaps it was her charm, or perhaps it was her piety, for she was a Christian, that finally an arrangement of arbitration was achieved. But in this arbitration, it was never consummated, because Arius died in Constantinople while on his way to be restored to his official dignities. This was the end of the one heresy, but it was the parent of many heresies that go on all the way through, not only the Christian faith, but most of the religions of the world. Every religion has had a council at somewhere along the line to try to straighten out its problems. And these problems are all based upon the lack of evidence that is generally acceptable concerning divine matters. To find an agreement between persons of different convictions, different ages, different races, different nations, these differences, how to reconcile them? Well, there's only one way that we have found up to date now in connection with this type of problem, and that is tolerance. The individual must recognize the rights of other people to believe according to their own beliefs. It is also very much more important to challenge the individual on the level of conduct, because there he can prove or disprove the integrity of his convictions. He may believe what he pleases, but his religion is revealed by what he does in action. And there can be no doubt that on this ground a compatibility is possible. If we judge a person by his merits alone, we can then have some confidence in his creed. The American Indian took this attitude completely. He never questioned the religion of a stranger. All he did was watch. And if the conduct was good, the stranger was good. And if he was good, the thing he believed had to be good. So that in this way, a lot of controversy was eliminated. Again today, we have the same problem that the Nicene Fathers faced, namely that there are a large number of schismatic fragments of all the religions that break away on some point of difference. Constantine thought most of these points of difference were rather unrealistic, and that others would not be solvable by the human mind. That some things had to be accepted by faith, and by faith alone. And that if faith was strong, the individual was strengthened. If his faith was weakened, his morality collapses. So it is faith which must take the place of knowledge in the study of the ultimates. The ultimate nature of deity, the ultimate purpose for the world, the ultimate end of man, these situations can be verbalized into more or less parables or simplifications, but the facts are beyond human conception. And these facts are not necessary. Man never needs to be to know more than he can reasonably learn in order to live as well as he can reasonably be expected to live. So from that time on to here, we find this long shadow of an old problem that is being more or less born again. This year, the world has many people with good ideals, with high hopes and severe and conscientious principles. And yet the great bodies of mankind, both religious and secular, have not been properly reconciled. Unless they are reconciled, they cannot lead the way to a world peace or a universal enlightenment. Education has certain advantages over theology because it deals mostly with things which can be demonstrated up to a certain point. And education generally quietly neglects or denies that which it cannot reach. But today, the struggle between materialism and idealism, it goes on because of the failure of human beings to sit down together and attempt the reconciliation of their differences. Perhaps the nearest thing we have today to the Council of Nicaea is the United Nations organization. And the delegates thereto are very much like the bishops of the 4th century. Most of them are writing letters criticizing each other. But the fact, man, is true, that something must be done to reconcile the common differences of mankind. And among these differences, there is a violence. There is a tyranny of attitudes. There is an unwillingness to arbitrate. There is a determination to live or die on a certain point or condition. In most cases, the elements involved are not especially valuable. When I was in New York a number of years ago, I gave a series of lectures in a building there, which was devoted very largely to philosophical discussions of one kind or another. And I learned while there that two very important sects of philosophical thinkers had wanted to use the facilities of this building. They had wanted to have the right to hold their own meetings there. But in both cases, it was understood that they could not possibly do it if the other group was admitted. Even if it was a different day, a different place, a different time, if one was admitted, the other would refuse to come. And that was in the recent years. So this type of thing is slow in breaking down. There are evidences that it is becoming somewhat better. And there are now groups that are able to get together who had no common ground 50 years ago. But the great problem still remains. The four or five great religions of the world all have essentially the same teachings. And as one great scholar of the past said, there are 70 names of God, but only one God. There are many faiths, but only one reality behind them all. And we have been divided for centuries by names and words. We have thought if the word was different, they were talking about a different thing. But this is not true. The one great thing that we have to learn is the divine law governing life. And we have to learn to get together and serve that law together and in cooperative relationships. World Fellowships of Faith, I attended the World High Congress of Religions, and many other groups trying to work out these problems. They have strong support from minority groups, from those who are not prejudiced, but the rest are in the same bad spot as that which confronted Constantine in 325 A.D. The situation must be clarified. We cannot permit this difference of opinion. We cannot permit any unreasonable, unfair condemnation of an individual on a principle which does not involve ethics or morality or integrity. Integrity we may demand. Ethics we may hope for. We may hope for honesty and consecration and sincerity. But we cannot expect complete agreement unless we broaden the foundation, enlarge the structure until it is inclusively possible to get everything into it. Now, at this time, we are gathered to celebrate the birthday of the greatest figure in the history of humanity. And the power of this figure in the transforming of the life of mankind cannot be overestimated. All the words that were written about him, all the gospels that try to interpret him, are secondary to the miracle of the fact itself. We found finally a voice that was the loudest voice that the world has ever heard, a voice which is still strong enough to control the religious life or influence the religious life of over half of the human race. Now, this power lies not in wealth, in militarism, despotism, or physical authority, but in the magnificent example which reaches into our lives and hearts and inspires us to do likewise. We are in the presence of a magnificent symbol of man's proper way of life, the constant recognition of loving one another, of serving truth, of sacrificing self for the common good, and for the recognition of the divine in all of its manifestations in all the areas of experience and phenomena. Recognizing this, we do have a tremendous wealth. A wealth of spiritual integrities, a wealth that cuts through all of the racial and economic and social states of humanity. We have many groups in the Christian communion from other nations, other races, from far places, and every phase of human culture has been influenced. So therefore, we need now perhaps to learn the lesson of the Council of Nicaea. To learn the lesson of finding a way to codify the entire concept of man's life. Several efforts have been made to write a religious book, a universal religious book. My old friend Dr. Riley tried to do it. He called it a Bible of the World, in which the best sections of all sacred books are brought together. This was a very noble experiment. Many profited by it, but it was not strong enough to move the situation in the direction that it has to go. The constant effort of these different beliefs to dominate each other is not consistent with the future well-being of humanity. No one wants to take these beliefs away from them, but it is necessary that they also hold strong enough beliefs in common to make possible a close fraternization and a complete cooperation with the cause of world peace and the improvement of the social condition. This goes back again to the mystical aspects of the early church as found perhaps best in Neoplatonism and in the doctrines of the Gnosis of Valentinus and Basilides. These recognized a great chemistry, a kind of alchemy, and the alchemists had it. That was the transformation of human nature. The old beliefs of the mystics, both Christian and non-Christian, have descended into Europe through the great teachings of men like Vehme and Paracelsus and Lully and other great leaders, a mystical thought, a deeper meaning, that the real problem is the transmutation of human nature, and that the transformation or universal reformation of humanity is the only solution to our problem. This was the original problem of the Gnosis and was one of the earliest problems of Christianity. The early church fathers believed firmly that the heavenly world would come to earth, that in due time and in due course there would be but one world, one humanity, living together in peace under one God. This dream still has validity. It is still something that we have to fight for, or work for, or struggle to attain. And unfortunately, up to the present time, it's been a very difficult path. Actually, however, there is progress. And the consideration of further details concerning early Christian history will have quite a bearing upon the future. Because as we go back to the original revelation and get away from the interpretations, we find a more solid substance upon which to build a unity. Interpretations of all kinds can grow up around an idea. But these interpretations are very conflicting and often contradictory. So if they can be eliminated and we go back to the idea in its own nature, in its own substance, in its own essence, we may find the common ground we need. We have to strip off centuries of interpretation to rescue the dream that was in the heart of the Christian religion. We are doing it in slow degrees, but it is coming. And when the time comes for it to really play its vital role in the reorganization of human society, it is only reasonable to hope that it will unite with all other faiths in the common purpose for which they all stand, and will not hesitate simply because another faith has a different name. That we will no longer consider the heretics and the non-believers. We will rather recognize that these are terms in our own minds, but that everywhere, from the beginning of time, religion has had one purpose, and that purpose was the improvement of the inner life of man. This is the thing that is most important. This is the emphasis that Paul made, both in his accepted epistles and those which are in the Apocrypha, that the great problem of all time and all things is that we all come together in the realization of the brotherhood of man and the fatherhood of God. Until this experience comes, we are not religious. The Gnostic Christians and some of the others had a mystical baptism, which is implied in some of the apocryphal writings, but not clearly set forth. In this mystical baptism, the individual simply stripped off all of the garments of his believing and went back to the source. That he was to start as a little babe again. But while he might be a grown person in body, he was a little child so long as his inner life was not strong enough to sustain him. The purpose of the child is to grow into an adult in whom the power of self-determination is sufficient to guide life. It is only the individual who can guide his own life in the way it should go whom has any right to be regarded as mature or grown up in his concepts. So the ancient rites often reduced the person again to a kind of second child, as is the words of Jesus, that the kingdom of heaven is the kingdom of little children, and that these little children, growing up in the faith, growing up in idealism, growing up in integrities, would ultimately become mature, and in their maturity would work together with all of their kind for the preservation of humanity and the safety of those little children who had not yet grown up. Thus, the purpose of the entire situation still is what it was in the beginning, to answer a primary question, namely, is there a power of infinite good at the source of life? Is there a law that determines all action? Are there realities that cannot be denied? Are there laws governing personal conduct that cannot be violated without tragedy? And are these laws the representations of the consciousness of the creating power? Are we therefore living in a universe in which there is a law giver, and we are expected to obey that law giver? This is against the concept that is held by some, that we are in a universe of accidents and incidents, that there is no rule governing anything, that the individual, while he is alive, and when he dies, he's dead, and that's all there is to it. This type of belief has made possible most of the miseries of the human race, and the idea that we must cling desperately to it, regardless of anything, is very much shadowed out again in the great argument between Arius and Alexander. Neither one would give a bit to the other. Neither one would admit that there could be anything wrong with his own interpretation of realities. As a result of that, the world has been locked, more or less, in a religious, scientific, philosophical, industrial, economic conflict for thousands of years. The answer seems to be that everything that happens points towards what is necessary. It points to solution, and the individual very often simply glosses over it very quickly for fear he might be tempted to solve something. He wants to go on as he is. This condition goes through all departments of life, economic, social, cultural. But the time must come when, through the experience of his own tragic mistakes, the human being comes back again to the realization that there is an archetype, there is a plan, there is a purpose. And those who are understanding and enlightened are either for this purpose or against it. And that there can be no compromise. We either must believe in the reality of the divine plan or disbelieve. If we believe, we have strength to meet many obstacles and problems with courage and integrity. If we do not believe, we find ourselves in a shipwrecked condition, in a world that is gradually falling apart. The apocryphal writings have been translated now from manuscripts in the Vatican and in several other great centers of culture. A number of them are available. One of them in the terms, the lost books of the Bible. They are suitable to be read and considered. They do not contain a vast amount of new information. For the large part, they are examples of intensification or elucidation of material already in the Gospels. But they strive to fill in breaks and points which are not clearly defined. They seek to answer certain natural questions that arise from the accepted books themselves. There is not as great a sublimity in them as there is in some of the recorded Gospels, but they do represent a striving after righteousness. They try to tell, sometimes almost like little children's fairy tales, things about Jesus and things about the lives of the apostles that make these apostles and persons more available to us in their simple friendships and in their ordinary actions and conditions. There we have, of course, a considerable discussion of the life of the Virgin. The Gospel of the Life of the Virgin God carries through from the Old Testament and through practically everything that we find in the New Testament regarding the genealogy of Jesus. We also have all kinds of little additional things thrown in to vitalize and make more interesting these classical accounts. And there's no doubt that many of these books would be a considerable inspiration to the average person. that they do indicate also that early there was a greater literature. But this greater literature, particularly in its more profound parts, is not present in the Apocrypha. The Apocrypha is a kind of commentary on the Gospels in substance, and with certain emendations, but with a slightly mystical flavor, a more miraculous approach, a reality of things that would be generally regarded today as magic or something of this nature. But the various divine personalities or worshippers or bishops are given powers and circumstances, and these in turn contributed to the Golden Legend, the first great book of the of Christian, we might say, mythology. Vortigern, in his Golden Legend, gives the lives of saints, the lives of martyrs. He is also the one who, for instance, gives us a clue to the sacred books of the Ethiopians. For there is another group of Apocrypha that we haven't considered at all, and that is books that arose in distant communions where the faith has remained unchanged for nearly 20 centuries. The Coptic Christianity of North Africa has its own commentaries, its own messengers, its own teachers and heroes, but it is still dominated by the Christian Gospels. So there are all kinds of side writings, some of them quite old, others simply representing the piety and enthusiasm of leaders of the 12th to 15th centuries. But in every case, there is something that gives a little new angle to the old problem. But mostly now, I think we are all concerned with what is found in the Apocrypha, as well as in the revealed Gospels or the accepted Gospels, is this great crisis, not as a prophetic thing. Some have tried to make this crisis a dated prophecy, particularly in the book of Revelation. But it is not a dated prophecy, it is timeless. The conflict between the individual and the pressures of the opinions of others, this conflict has always existed. The desperate effort to maintain uniformity, even at the expense of progress, has also survived to us from the past. I think we do need, very definitely, a new concept of basic interpretation. We do not need to touch the scriptures themselves, but we need to create a text dealing with the use of them in the immediate problems of international affairs. We need to help people in this world recognize that they shouldn't drive a car under the influence of alcohol, that they should take care of their children properly, that they should produce entertainment that is fit to see, and that always the man is responsible to a divine law and a divine purpose. But he will not serve that purpose or that law unless he believes in it. And in lacking belief, he must live with the consequences of his disbelief, and this consequence is very serious. So as then, so now, for nearly 1,800 years, the Christian authority has been diminished by feudalism. It has been damaged by conflict within itself, conflicts that have never really been solved. Some of them partly arbitrated so that people can get along in the same community without actually warring over it. But still in the lives of many people, their own peculiar creed is true, and all others are untrue. As long as this remains as it is, the munition makers will have a busy day. As long as we permit differences in our personal convictions to destroy friendships, break up homes, and damage characters, we cannot blame others for the difficulties that follow. We are now very much in need of what Constantine recognized so long ago. We need of getting together all of those of good spirit and letting their power be available to that more legitimate leadership, which might in turn finally solve the present problem. In other words, if the leaders believe in the people, and the people believe in their leaders, things will go better. But the only way this can be accomplished is if the people and the leaders both believe in principles and believe in the integrities and values of life upon which civilization must stand. So now we have another Christmas season coming to us out of the past, an opportunity to restate in our own lives values which inwardly we know to be true, but we have never allowed them to really interfere with doing as we please. The time has come, I think, to think of Christmas more as a rededication, a recognition of an eternal value, a value which we can reject and perish or accept and live. That the teachings that are essential were not essentially given to the world by only one teacher. Honesty is a world conviction. Kindness is a world conviction. Buddhism is waiting for the Lord Maitreya, whose name means kindness. And kindness is to be the coming savior of mankind. Whether we call it the Lord Maitreya or the Messiah, it is the same thing. For it is the quality, the principle, and the energy which the word symbolizes that doeth the works. It is not the word. So everywhere we are waiting for world peace, world understanding, world cooperation. We are seeking to feed the hungry and fulfill all of those requirements which Jesus bestowed upon his apostles. And in order to do these things, we must begin to think in terms of solution and realize that while this may be a little difficult, while we may find it hard to give up some of our pet notions or to share our goods with the unfortunate, that in the long run, it is the virtue of the truly religious person to work constantly against the selfishness in himself and gradually recover from the blind spot which he has permitted to develop, in which he is able to live his daily life without consideration for the spiritual importance of the things that happen. The happenings of daily life are symbols of the quality of human attainment. And where the happening comes to sorrow, it means there's something wrong in the conduct of the person. A sorrowful, weeping world is a world that has departed from principles. It can only come back to those principles and survive. Therefore, at Christmas, we are constantly reminded of an eternal mystery. The mystery of the love of deity manifesting upon all planes of existence. And this so happens that if the love of deity is with us, our love should be with deity, with the doing the works, so that in a little way at least, we are all bishops. We are all members of a kind of world clergy in which our dedication is primarily to the works of righteousness. If these thoughts can be strong in our hearts and minds at this time during the Christmas season, I think we will be more serious. We will still enjoy the good, but let us remember that when we give presents, in a sense, these presents are intended to represent rewards. The little boy who is naughty is not supposed to get a Christmas present. The grown man who is naughty is not expected or not able to claim a happy life, the respect and love of his friends and family. We are rewarded by the mysterious gifts of grace that react from our own conduct. And each individual who lives a little nearer to the truth will find in himself that he is a little nearer to peace, security, happiness, and world unity. These are the things that we must give consideration to, especially this year. For we see now, that, as never before perhaps, the dangers of selfishness and materialism. They simply will not operate. And unless we are able to do a little better with the subject, we are going to drift along to one tragedy after another. It is not the name of the power we believe that is the most important. It is that our belief leads to obedience. That what we know to be true, we do. And this is the part of life that is important to us, because most of us do know better than we do. And if we do what we do know, we will know more. For each development of character releases from within ourselves a new wealth of mystical overtones and insights and understandings. So we'd like to wish for all of you this year a new dedication to the great principles of truth, new friendship, the ability to say more and more that there is no belief in the world that you are going to criticize, that you're going to do everything possible to help everyone live his beliefs in terms of the one truth behind them all. And that if we will overlook appearances and stay with principles, we can accomplish something for nearly everyone who comes into our lives. So having a deep insight into meaning yourself, into the realization that if we love truth, we will keep its commandments. And if we believe in Christ, we will keep his commandments. If we will kind of make this a living, firm establishment within ourselves, we'll have a better new year, and the whole world will be better. For there is not one single good deed committed by one person that does not contribute to the final perfection of the human race. So with these thoughts, our blessings are with you for this holy season.